The following is Thomas Vanderwall's talk, Getting More Out of Social with Focus on Social Comfort, from the 2012 Information Architecture Summit. The 2012 IA Summit podcasts are brought to you by User Interface Engineering and the UIE Virtual Seminar Program. Stay tuned after the podcast for a special offer from UIE.
Good morning, New Orleans. One more time. Good morning, New Orleans. Excellent. All right, I am Thomas Vanderwall. I have my own company, InfoCloud Solutions. I've been running that since about 2005. And my background goes back around social and collaboration type tools back to 1996. And so I have an awful lot of lessons learned and an awful lot of different perspectives from managing and being the person whose pants catch on fire if things don't go right, and people saying, oh, we're going to fire or sue or something because somebody is acting out in a forum or other things. And so learned an awful lot from that and then started designing, developing, and maintaining various social platforms. And so what I'm going to talk about today in social comfort is something that came out of these lessons learned and how things sort of work, and taking a perspective that gives you a lens to be able to see things a little bit differently and to have a better, deeper understanding so that you can design and frame things so that people use the systems and feel more comfortable and start embracing them a little bit better. So I'm going to start off with a non-digital story. I got out of college in 1988, a long time ago, many dog years ago, and the first job that I had was in San Francisco at the Commonwealth Club of California. And it was essentially sort of a speakers platform, sort of like the National Press Club. They put on anywhere from 400 to 600 events a year, had speakers, renowned speakers from all around the globe, as well as local people. And one of the things that I did with my job was sitting on the boards and the different sort of governance groups and committees within the organization. And one of the things that was really strange was that these groups were made up of vice presidents, senior vice presidents, presidents, CEOs of banks. So at that point, you had Bank of America, Wells Fargo, you had Chevron, other large national organizations. And these committees were made up of 10 people, 14 people. And one of the things that was really strange to witness is when they would have changeover and one new person would come in, and all this great conversation and the group dynamics stopped. It stopped for about two sessions. And one of the things that was happening was that they weren't quite comfortable with this new person who was there, because they knew that they could interact and tell stories about what was happening with their job and their workplace, and they knew that the other people around the table weren't going to go back to their companies, possibly competitors, and share those stories. And so what they started doing in the 2 years that I was there was they started saying, if we get a new member coming on, everybody before the next meeting has to go have lunch with them one-on-one to get comfortable with them, to get to know them. And so the group dynamics would start working. So we start taking this understanding from the non-digital environment and start getting to try to understand how sort of mainstream, how sort of the non-20%, the non-early adopters are using social platforms and social tools in their real life, and also understanding things from mainstream adoption and how social interactions work in the world around us. One of the things that I was doing in about 2004, 2005 was going to companies and getting invited in. And people are like, yeah, we've got this problem, and people aren't using the wiki. And I'm like, ah, let's go grab some coffee and talk to people in the hallway on the way there. And would run into people in the hallway. I'm like, hey, do you guys know that you have a wiki in your organization? Oh, yeah, we've run across that. It comes up in search. Well, have you ever added anything? And the first person that I talked to said, oh, I don't want to be the company idiot. And this idea of being the company idiot like took me back a little bit. And they're like, what do you mean? They're just like, well, you know, if I put something out there, it might be wrong, and you know, it's out there for everybody to see. And they're like, you know, that information that's in the wiki is really helpful when we run across it, but you know, I don't want to change it if it's wrong, because I might be wrong. And so this idea, I'm like, wow, this seems really strange. Talk to five or six more people on the way to go get coffee. Four of them said, I don't want to be the company idiot or something very close to it. I'm like, wow, this is an odd trend. And over the years since then, this is kind of the norm. Sort of how sort of the mainstream technical press talks about social software and sort of the social media gurus talk about things is this understanding of sort of the edge cases, the early adopters. And when they're talking about us in that perspective, it doesn't really apply to the other 80%, how regular people are mainstream. And when you start thinking about Twitter and 40% of the people who are on Twitter check in every day, they're reading things, they're doing all sorts of things with it, but they have never tweeted. They are heavy users of Twitter, And when you start thinking about that and start thinking about, I don't want to be the company idiot, you start having an understanding of sort of where things are. One of the things we need to do is to look at sort of how humans are social in non-digital environment. Essentially, what are the social scripts? When you meet somebody at a conference and like this, and you walk up to somebody, you're like, hey, I'm so-and-so, and they're like, what's your name? And you ask a question, and what that question is like, where are you from? What do you do? Why are you here? Are you enjoying it? There are certain like common norms that we have in sort of Western culture, but each culture and subculture has their own social scripts on how we interact with other people, how we get familiar, how we figure out, this is somebody who I have an affinity with, this is somebody who I want to get to know better, this is somebody I want to completely ignore, and that's completely fine. One of the things we need to do when we start taking this real world, sort of this fleshy world, and bringing it into the digital world is to begin to rethink how the social tools are working and start mapping to human needs. One of the things I talk about continually is that our digital social tools aren't really social as humans are social. They haven't quite mapped to that yet. And quite often, it's a large chasm that we need to be crossing. One of the things that comes up an incredible amount with social tools, and particularly people who don't have an awful lot of depth, is there's an incredible discussion about trust. We need trust. We need to trust the tools, we need to trust the people. And if you're a designer or you're a developer and you're working with people and they're saying, yeah, well, the trust system in this doesn't really work. I'm like, can you please tell me, you know, how you're defining trust? Because there's 6 or 7 good definitions of trust that are not fungible. They are completely different. They don't overlap at all. And so the people will describe what they mean by trust, and they talk for about 2 sentences, and all of a sudden they shift their definition. I'm like, you just shifted your definition. Can you define how you're using trust now? And in 2008, in the fall, I said, no more using trust. Anybody that I'm working with, you are not allowed to use the word trust. You've got to use a proxy term. And so once I started doing that, I said, you know, I'm trying to design, understand what's broken, how to make all this stuff better, help figure out if it's the tool or if it's the people, all these different things. And it's like, let's get this back into something that we can work with and design from. And so by encouraging the use of other words to describe trust or to be a proxy for trust, there was a bunch of words and terms that started coming up. One of them was respect. I'm like, oh, I respect this person. They have pretty good feedback. I can do things with the information that they give me. I have comfort with this person. I can share things with them, and I'm not feeling like an outcast. I'm not feeling like the company idiot. There's also they're dependable. I can give them something. I know that they're going to do it, and they'll take action on it, and it will be done. It's valued. When I ask them a question, the feedback that I get, it is valuable. If this person went away, you know, it would be a disaster, or it would be lessening sort of the organization or the interactions or just sort of the world at whole. Honesty is another important part of trust. And that's like, you know, when you're getting information, you're like, this person is saying, you know, that this is their information, the information that they're giving you, it is actually coming out of experience, or, you know, they're giving you the real dirt. The information is treasured, or the person or the resource is a treasured resource. Also, there's an awful lot of people that were like, you know, when they stopped using trust, they started talking about love, and it's like, wow, we really love this person. The feelings that we get from them, how we respond with them, or they're talking about tools, as odd as it seems, and like, we love this tool. It's easy to interact with. We know what it does. We know how far our sharing is going and who is seeing the things that we're putting in it. Things are believable. Being able to say, yeah, this not only is credible, but it's believable. And there's that sort of definition of trust and use. And things are consistent, and et cetera. There's many different things, but one of the things that bubbled up over and over again was the idea of comfort. And so started framing things and thinking about things in a framing of social comfort. And it's like, you know, people interacting with tools, and they're like, yeah, I'm comfortable using this tool. I know where it goes. I'm comfortable interacting with this other person. You know, I'm not feeling like I'm being belittled. I know that I can share information. They're going to vet it and say, wow, you really can't say that about the manager. You know, as much as he might be a prick, you really can't say that. And so those people are looking out for you, and they've got your back, and so you have this comfort. And I started realizing that there was not only one understanding of social comfort, but there's essentially 3 components of social comfort. It's social comfort with people, it's social comfort with the tools, and the last is social comfort with the content. And so I'm gonna start walking through these and start off with social comfort with people. One of the things I had sort of stumbled across a few years back was the elements of social software. And if you're trying to share information and get information out of your head and share it with other people, there's a certain set of things that we do and a certain pattern and process. With the elements of social software, it starts off with identity and an object. Somebody is within the system, they have an account, they have an avatar, they have presence in the system, and they find an object that they have interest in. It could be a movie, it could be a document, it could be a tweet. There's something that's out there that they have interest in. So essentially, this is the initial framing of a social object. So the first thing that we have is the presence in the system. So they have logged into a system, it recognizes them, authenticates them. If I'm checking into a system, I'm quite often Vanderwall, all lowercase, all run together. That's how I know I'm me. And so it's like, okay, I have something that's in the system, my identity has been checked, and I'm free to move forward. The next thing is, there's an action. You want to take an action around this. You want to bookmark it, you want to tag it, you want to blog it, you want to tweet it, you want to capture it as a video, share it out on another service, annotate it in some way. But there's essentially something that this triggers in your head, and you're like, wow, I want to capture this and get it out of my head, get it into digital form, and the next thing that you probably want to do is share it. And so being able to share it, and within the framing of social comfort, figure out how far you want to be able to share it. So being able to share that information and say, oh, I want this just to go to my friends, the six friends that I'm really tight with, I want to share this with them, or share it with my colleagues at work that I'm working on a team project with, or share it with the division, share it with all of North America in the company, or share it globally around with all 300,000 people in the company. But one of the things that's really important in the order of this is that most often in social tools, this order is flipped. By going to the tool, how broadly you're going to share it is set before you do an activity. You're not allowing people to get what is in their head, get it out of their head, and get it into the system and into the tool, and before the sharing, so they're having to think, wow, I'm using this tool, so this goes around to my division, this will go out to everybody, I don't have a way to hone it in, and to bring it back and be able to say, oh no, I just want this to go to family, I just want this to go to my good friends, leave my family out of this, leave my coworkers out of this. So if we get the order and have helped organizations and have helped developers and designers flip this interaction and say, okay, get what's in their head, let people do their action, how they want to do it, what they have their preference with, and then decide how far they want to share it, the adoption and the engagement with the tools and services jumps drastically. Because they'll put something in there and they might put everything that they're thinking about into it, and like, wow, I'm not really comfortable with this. And so they'll like scale it back a little bit, and that's okay. But when you start setting the boundaries, people start limiting and controlling and filtering what they're saying. The next thing is other people are seeing it. So they're tied to your reputation, they're in the system, or they're tied to your identity, and they see whatever you have said, your activity around that object, surfaces for them. They're like, wow, the reputation is really quick. I like this, this is interesting, this is not interesting. And when you get through that, you have the reputation component. And people are like, yeah, interesting, not. The next step comes along and it becomes a relationship. Oh, I want to give feedback. I want to interact with them. Or it's like, hey, this is somebody I want to hold on to. And one of the things I've pushed for about 4 years or 5 years is having the ability to test people and sample people. You have no idea who somebody is, but they're saying interesting things. Is this the norm for them? And be able to have the system pop up 2 weeks later or a month later and say, hey, you're sampling Vanderwall. Do you want to put him in your regular list or you want to drop him? You know, he says some really stupid stuff. You know, what do you want to do? But you have this relationship set, and so you know, you're holding on to them and putting them in sort of this space. And the next thing that comes along is, wow, there's a conversation. They say, hey, did you also see this other article? Did you see this other video? Or, hey, this is pretty good. I hadn't seen this. Thanks for sharing. And so you start having this conversation around it. But one of the things that you realize is it isn't just the two of you with an affinity or an interest around the social object. There's more people, and you start having groups. And there's group discussions, and one of the things that comes out of group discussions is that, wow, there's something really here. Maybe we can change the world with this, or maybe we can get a bring our pets to work employee policy. And so what you need to do is to have real collaboration. So you're collecting information, sharing information, you're having groups discussing it, but if you start framing things as collaboration using the Denning and Yernofsky real collaboration, where you have all these different multitudes of things that you can do, so you've got seven different ways that you can frame a bring your pet to work employee policy, but you can only have one policy. You can't have all seven. So you need to negotiate and mitigate within this collaboration to get to that one endpoint. So what we have is this build order, and it moves its way up, and this is for people who are sharing information and how you get social comfort in allowing them to engage and being able to think through the different steps, what the tools and the services have that you're offering, what you're trying to maintain, or being able to identify gaps. I'm like, wow, we really don't have one of these, or we're not strong here, so you know, maybe we need to fill this in. This is now sort of the third wave of social tools. Back in the 90s, the traditional groupware, where people collaborated and shared information and were trying to work and the tools weren't all that great, was that a boss said, hey, you know, the 14 of you are going to be a new project team. Why don't you guys get to know each other? And so you start with the relationship building, have the conversations, the groups, and the collaboration. But one of the things that we're doing with the social software tools is we have all this other stuff that needs to come before it. And if we're not accounting for this, and if we're just sort of throwing the tools out there and saying, you know, the field of dreams, let them come and play. If they build it, they will come. That doesn't really work if we don't have the other pieces underneath it and help people get through that social comfort. One of the huge questions with this and around identity is, who are these people? It's a huge problem in most of the systems, and trying to figure out, if you know three David Smiths, which David Smith is this? There's a David Smith who I don't want to share an awful lot of information with, and there's one who I care about an awful lot that I would share anything and everything with. And so being able to understand that, but also if you're thinking about it inside an organization, who are these people? And when you look at company profiles, one of the problems with profiles is they don't really tell you an awful lot about who the person is for what you need for work perspective. And one of the things that we need to start thinking about is, what is this familiarity thing? And there's a paradox around familiarity, and there can be familiarity through working together, and you get to know people, you know, a fair amount, other, you know, working or sharing things with people who you're not completely familiar with. You're like, oh yeah, I kind of know this new David Smith. There's a fourth David Smith. And so you begin to understand sort of who they are, and it's like you think you have a pretty good understanding of them, but you're only seeing a slice of their life, not everything. You also have familiarity through reputation, what other people have said, what has come before them. And then there's this funny thing that happens in organizations with the hallway familiarity. At 10:14 every single morning, you're on their way to the cafe to go get a cup of coffee, and somebody walks by you, and after 3 months, you start saying hello, and you get to know them really well in that 10 seconds that you see them and say good morning every morning at 10:14. 9 months later, you're sitting across a conference table, and there's this 10:14 person, and you're like, wow, I know this person really well. All I've done is say hi, and they've got a cup of coffee in their hand, and I'm going to get mine. And so it has a sort of like odd sense of familiarity and sort of an uncanny valley in the real life of, is this firm ground? Do I know them? Do I trust them? Do I have comfort with them? I don't really know anything about them. And we need to be careful of that within the systems that we're building. Do we have real familiarity, or is it hallway familiarity? If we're going to be building social comfort with people, one of the things that we look at is similar interest, and beginning to understand part of the social script is figuring out similar stories. And you're working with somebody and you run across them, we're like, yeah, you know, where do you work? Oh yeah, we're like, that's interesting. I know a couple of people that work there, and they're like, oh, I used to work, you know, at another company. We're like, wow, I work there too. And you start playing this game of, you know, did you overlap in years, and what group were you in, you know, what projects and so forth. And so you start going through the social scripts and trying to figure out the similar life stories and what the connections are. And we do this, and we can be anywhere on the globe, and we're trying to figure out with someone when we're in Denmark and they're from Kenya, who do we know in common? And there's like 6 billion people, what are the odds? But quite often, you're in the same place at the same time, there's going to be some connection of some strange way. And we'd play this game, and it's part of our regular human social scripts, or at least for those of us that go to conferences. And the last thing is understanding sort of the similar experiences. And they're like, oh, you know, I just lost my goldfish this last week. Oh, yeah, you know, losing a pet is horrible. And so you have that common experience in figuring out, you know, where you are in life and having these common bonds. One of the things that was really interesting a few years back at South by Southwest was on a panel about tagging, and Ben Brown, who had developed a dating tool on the web called Consummating, he was also on the panel. And one of the things that was different about Ben Brown's Consummating tool was the whole dating site was based on tags. You tag yourself, other people would tag you, you go on a date, they tag you again, and you start building this sort of base of tags around who people are, what you are. And one of the things that they started stumbling across was there was this quirkiness factor. And so the quirkiness factor is essentially rarities that are difficult to come across. And that number shifts. And at the time that he was talking, it was about 200,000 people in the system, maybe 400,000 he was talking about when they had 200,000. They were essentially taking two tags. And if you had one tag and you had it in common with somebody else, what's sort of the rare co-occurrence of tags? And so they would say, if there's four people with that same co-occurrence of tags in their whole system and up to about 24, that sort of fell into this quirkiness factor. The moderator of the panel had met his wife through consummating, and they fell into the quirkiness factor, and Heath Rowe, who used to work at Fast Company, he explained the quirkiness factor. He lived in Manhattan. He was a Manhattanite. That was one of his tags. This woman who he married and met through consummating, she was a Manhattanite. Common. Millions of people in New York City area, you know, that doesn't really narrow it down. Heath was a mountain climber. She was a mountain climber. Mountain climbers, a whole heck of a lot of them around the globe, a whole lot of them in consummating. Manhattanite, mountain climber, not so many. There were seven at the time. They fell into the quirkiness factor, and it's one of those things where you're just like, wow, what are the odds that I could ever meet somebody else with, like, you know, that understands me and understands this odd set of who I am, and that became the quirkiness factor. And people who met that fit within the quirkiness factor had an insanely high propensity of having a long-term relationship, whether it was just as a friend and somebody who they kept going out to dinner with, or whether they became significant others in sort of that significant otherness of the world. And so just being able to keep that in mind of understanding sort of that quirkiness and being able to have systems say, hey, yeah, there's another person who understands how to speak Japanese and is also an information architect. And it's like, you know, what are the odds inside the company of 30,000 that there is that when, you know, the company doesn't have an Asia presence? And they're like, okay, I've got somebody who I can commiserate, risen, talk with about this, and somebody who understands me. And so understanding sort of how this quirkiness builds into the social comfort and understanding the ability to build bonds and to understand people a little bit better is really helpful. Another one is transparency and ensuring that there's transparency in our systems and services and being able to say, you know, this is the information that I have and understanding and being able to point to the different resources, being able to not only recommend people but vouch for them. And because you're putting your own reputation on the line if you're vouching for somebody else rather than just giving a recommendation. In the identity community, there's an awful lot of talk about vouching for reputation systems because you put your own reputation at stake. And when you're putting your own reputation on stake and being able to say, yeah, this is a good person, they know an awful lot about this, or they have the capabilities to do these other sets of things, that becomes incredibly important. But being open and transparent about who we are is quite helpful. That leads to profiles. And profiles are really, really poor right now, particularly inside the firewall. When we think about the quirkiness factor, they might give some of that, but one of the things that's really broken with them is that we need to build our profiles from the perspective of the people viewing them, not of the person who's sharing the information. Looking at a person's profile inside a company and they're like, been with the company 8 years, here's the hierarchy that I am, here's who I report to, here's my senior VP that I roll up into, I like walking on the beach at sunsets, I like flying kites, and I have a dog, doesn't help me. Understanding that they worked on the same project as two of your coworkers 3 years ago, that's really helpful. They're like, wow, I can get information that's going to be helpful, or that project was really difficult, and they might have the nugget and be able to tap them. It's like, okay, this is good to know. The things about their work history or where they've been, you know, other depths really help you. Or if you're that person who speaks Japanese and they have Japanese as a language and have that surface and become bold and stand out to the person, that begins helping and breaking down those bonds and building that social comfort. Lastly, on people, what are the things that sort of erode comfort? It's sort of that lack of transparency or finding out somebody is not who they say they are. Being able to have somebody who's working in a forum and you realize, wow, they're not just sort of one of us who have, you know, was working with a group that had cancer survivors. And one of the people who was in the forum was talking about an awful lot of things, and they were one of the paid people who was monitoring, helping the group out, but they had acted like they were a cancer survivor. And when they found out they were paid and actually there, that forum just died. People lost, you know, all the comfort. They didn't know who anybody was. And like, well, how many others are paid here? Who is who? And so, you know, being able to make sure that you have that transparency and they aren't any gotchas is incredibly important. Social comfort with tools is the second of the three social comforts. And social comfort with tools is, you know, most people aren't comfortable as much as Mark Zuckerberg wants to believe, we are not openly social people. We do not share our information openly with everybody easily. Those of us who are broken, we have no problem doing that. We'll put all sorts of crazy stuff out on Twitter and people are like, are you crazy? Maybe. But most humans aren't that way. We want to share information, be able to have a comfortable space where it's like, oh yeah, I know everybody who's here, I'm comfortable with them, I know what's going on. And having those tools that provide that sort of comfort in that walled garden, have the information freely seep out once it's been vetted and you're comfortable sharing it to that next level out, becomes important. I had stumbled across this in about 2006 and 2007 with SharePoint. And when SharePoint 2.7 came out, it became really prominent because SharePoint 2007 default was that everything was a closed walled garden. And I would sit down with CIOs, and CIOs are like, yeah, we put SharePoint in place, and we went from 6 silos in our organization to 400 in 2 months. We can't get the information out. We don't know who is sharing information. We can't search it. We can't reuse it. We'd have nothing going on. People are thinking they're doing a great service to the organization. They're sharing things, and the organization's getting smarter, and they're like, we are dumber than ever because everybody thinks they've done their job, and they've done a great deed. So I'm like, okay, what is it with the SharePoint default and these walled gardens? People love the walled gardens. They know who is in there. They know the 25 people. I'm like, the social comfort is really important. But when you start opening things up and saying, oh yeah, we're moving from SharePoint and now we move to sort of an early Yammer where everybody in the organization sees everything that's shared out, that sharing goes from maybe 40% over 6 months that are sharing in the small, tight walled gardens to 6%. So you're losing people, and all of a sudden you start realizing that this Web 2.0 thing and the millions of people who are using it are only a tiny slice of the billions of people who are out there, and the 1.5 billion who are on the web. I'm like, those numbers and percentages pretty much are identical from the web and rolling into sort of what happens inside organizations and understanding sort of different personality types and how humans are social within those personality types and culture. And so what we really want to move to is moving to the comfortable spaces with permeable walls, a place where we can share information, vet it, make sure we're not being the company idiot or saying something stupid, and being able to move on. We're not stepping on other people's toes. Another thing that I've run across an incredible amount and started presenting on this and talking about it more broadly about 4 years ago, it's the social reticence of a click. So if you see the star within Gmail, you say, oh, this is something I want to hold on to. If you see the star in Twitter, it's a little bit more open and sharing, and it has all sorts of different meanings. And there's an awful lot of arguments within social media experts and gurus who are like, oh, this is the one way to use the star. Everybody else is using it wrong. Well, everybody's right, because everybody has their own culture and subcultural context for what this means. When you bring this understanding inside the firewall to an organization, it begins to have serious problems. When you have different people trying to sort out what is meant by a star, it can have detrimental effects. But the first thing we start out with is, how broadly are my activities being shared? If I'm clicking on something, is this just for me, like Gmail? Is this for Twitter? Can some people see it? Is everybody seeing this? How broadly is it shared? So we start getting back to that elements of social software. Understanding how broadly something is shared, if you don't know how broadly it's shared, you may not click it. What do others think this means? Which becomes to be really important. And when I started presenting about this, we'd get an awful lot of people saying, yeah, we've got this problem in our company. After about 2 years, 2.5 years of this, someone came up after I had presented, and they're like, yeah, I've got a story at my company. We actually had somebody fired because of this. They had someone who was working on a project, putting in like 60-hour weeks. They're like, my project's finished in 3 weeks. I'm going to have time. There's a white paper that came out talking about, let's say, going into Latin America, and the company was going to expand outside of North America, and there were 16 items that were in the white paper. The person had looked at it and said, wow, this doesn't seem right. But he's like, our company moves kind of slowly. We've got 6 months usually between something getting put out. I can give feedback, and we're not going to act on it. Somebody else in the organization is a huge fan of social software and these open collaboration tools and saying, wow, we can move so much faster. And the star thing here means that somebody has approved it, and it's a checkbox as, yeah, I agree with this. Well, the person who had put the star on it was thinking, I'm just holding on to this. They're a heavy user of Gmail. So I'm like, it has no social meaning. It doesn't mean that I like it, don't like it. It just means it's my bookmark so I can have it within easy access, and it separates it out from all the other chat that gets in our way. And so what happened was the person who was saying, yeah, this is a check mark, had the ear of upper management. And they're like, wow, look, you know, all the 18 people that we needed to have sign off on this have signed off. And they checked no further to go back and validate. They're like, wow, we paid this person an awful lot who is talking about the social software. They must know what they're talking about. And so the company started rearranging people, moving packages, having new directors come in. They were in the 7 to 8 figures of buying property and getting arrangements in Latin America. And all of a sudden the guy comes who had put the favorite on it to hold on to it. It's like, whew, you know, glad that project's done. You know, what have I bookmarked? Oh yeah, comes back to it. 6 items of the 16 things. If we do this, we are going to lose our reputation not only in Latin America, but it could tank the company, and the company could probably close out of great embarrassment and just being complete idiots. And we can't do this. So he wrote up his response and sent it out, and it bubbled up instantly to the CEO. And the CEO is like, this is a massive, very expensive, very painful screw up. A head has got to go. So I started including that in my presentation. Within 3 months, I had somebody else give almost an identical story. So being able to understand what it means and what the social contexts are within the different elements that we all understand, but not everybody has that same understanding, is really important. So understanding what the features, functions, and tools and services do is incredibly valuable. So if we start thinking about the favorite and the star again, when we click this, what we really should have, if we're trying to keep a simple interface that isn't really cluttered, is click on it and have a hover. I want to pin it to hold on to it. I want to be able to put a star on it saying I have interest. It doesn't mean that I like it or don't like it. It just means that I have interest in this. We might want to also have a smiley face saying, hey, I like this, and then a checkbox or a thumbs up to say, hey, I approve of this, move on. And so we're taking all these intents that people have around why they're clicking on something and what they think that they're saying and being able to disambiguate it and make it a little bit more clear while still keeping the interface relatively simple. And then quickly go through the social progressions of social software. So when we start thinking about Twitter and other things, just sort of these lightweight, massive amount of volume of information that flows, can frame it, I can call it the social progression of fire. We start off with sparks. Somebody has lit a match, throws it up there, and these things just sort of float through Twitter, Yammer, all the different activity streams, and there's interesting information. Somebody's paying attention, like, wow, 6 of these are kind of interesting. They're from 4 different people. Let me pull them together. Let me see if we can get more information on this. So we go from having a spark and then different sparks of inspiration that we want to then turn into a campfire. Essentially have people gather around, dump their information, get the people who have affinity to capture their information, share it out with the other people who have affinity, see how much there is, capture the good, the bad, as much as you can, maybe bring a few other people into it, get good conversation going, and start saying, hey, do we have something that our company, our organization, our city, you know, our nation, you know, can we use this stuff? Is it valuable? So we've gone from the spark to the campfire, and they're like, yeah, we've got enough here. Maybe we need to take it to some more people. So you move from the campfire to the bonfire. The bonfire is adding more fuel to it so that more people can see it, more feedback. So if you're thinking about inside an organization, and you have these, you know, 6 or 10 people that have done the campfire, done their, you know, knowledge drop, and they framed how it, they think it could work, and there's many different avenues, but now you've gone to engineering, you've gone to development, you've gone to logistics, you've gone to packaging, you've gone to the labeling folks, everybody is getting their feedback and saying, yeah, if we're going to be doing this, we need to think about the lining and the packaging. Seems like a good idea. Well, here's a gap in it. But people, as they're talking about it around the bonfire, are not only identifying gaps, but they're also identifying potential solutions. So you start gathering that back, and you're like, wow, we possibly could do something with this. Let's see how it works out. And so you sort of move between the bonfire and the campfire, and where you're ultimately heading to is getting to the torch. And being able to have something that's safe, replicatable, there's one way to do it, it's easy to hand off, and you know, you're going to have to work through the real collaboration to get to the torch mode, and being able to take the 7 different potential paths and being able to think through them, mitigate and negotiate to get down from the 7 down to 1. You might have, you think, okay, C is going to be a really good option. With C, we need a little bit of D. And so just being able to get to this, you've got the different progressions and trying to think through the tools and the social interaction design that's needed for the spark stage and have an easy handoff to go from the spark stage to the campfire stage to be able to grab those tweets or things in the activity stream and move them into something that's a little more permanent, and you can start having actionable interactions around them to gather more information. And being able to go from the campfire, having that comfortable space, and then being able to have the permeable walls to open it up to everybody for feedback to get to the bonfire, have the social interaction design to be able to go from the bonfire to the campfire and begin to work toward the torch mode so that you're capturing all the information. Why did we not use E? Why did we go with C? And be able to capture that for future understanding. And so going from this and moving into the last element, which is social comfort with content, what we're optimally trying to do is capture 100% of all that is potentially shareable and be able to get what is potentially shareable out of people's heads into something that's digital. In 2004, I had a conversation at IA Summit with somebody from Sun, or it might have been later than that. And one of the things that they were talking about was they were starting to sell off their properties. They were allowing people to telecommute. And they were talking about all the great hallway conversations and the brilliant ideas, sort of the shower moments, but they happen in hallways with people clothed and not, avoid that metaphor in the future. But they have like these great ideas and the great things happen in the hallways and these spark of ideas, by the time they get back to their desk, it's floated off and they've got 9 new emails all marked important and they lose it. And they said one of the things that happened at Sun when they started allowing people to telecommute and using digital hallways is that the hallways were no longer forgetful. The hallways now had memory. Because all those brilliant moments and those clicks of ideas where you're like, wow, that's really good, it's all captured. And being able to capture that idea, hold on to it as if it were a spark to be able to move into a campfire and say, hey, anybody else, what do you guys think about this? Are there any legs to it? Being able to do that was really valuable. But being able to capture all of that information, to capture that 100% of what you're thinking and get it into a digital hallway, give it into a digital component, it's really helpful. And then sort out how broadly you're going to share it. So if you can think about somebody who is, you know, working in a warehouse, and you know, the warehouse guy has absolutely no credibility with marketing, but he has sisters and aunts who are using your shampoo product, but all of the marketing is aimed at other people. You know, he and his family are not white. All of the marketing, it's like only white people use the shampoo. Why can't we market to other people? Because it even does a better job with our hair than it does for white people. And so, you know, how is the warehouse guy going to have any credibility? So he has a good idea, but how does he share it? How does, you know, that start moving out? And so understanding sort of the paradox of the content sharing, and when people need to find others like me, who can I share this with? How can the warehouse guy connect with somebody in the organization who's going to take his information, vet the information, sharpen it, hone the information so he doesn't feel like the company idiot, and being able to provide comfort around that so he's able to share and the organization's able to get much better. How do we do that? Being able to take the more personal issues, and so if somebody has an issue, you know, with whether they're sick at work, whether, you know, they've run out of sick leave because they've been really sick, you know, how do you deal with that? How do you find other people? How do you find a place to share this? One of the things, you know, the more uncomfortable the situation, the less people are comfortable to share things, the more of an outlier you are. Looking at sort of the externally focused social empathy, being able to understand why people aren't sharing, quite often we'll hold back some of the content because we were afraid it might hurt others. You know, even though the boss might be a complete jerk, you know, we still aren't willing to hurt them. They're like, yeah, kind of a nice guy, but you know, we're not really sure that we really want to hurt them, but also not wanting to rock the boat and like capturing information. Yeah, we've got a good thing going. I think there might be some potential to do something, but I don't want to see the person shaking things up. And then also sort of whistleblowing concerns. Am I going to be seen as the person that's outing everything? And so just having that comfort so people are sharing things and sort of moving these fears and bringing them back in. So when we start thinking about social software and using them, we need to start thinking about social software from a social comfort and social comfort as a whole, from the people, the tools, as well as the content, and making it a place where there is comfort, where people are willing to interact. They know how broadly things are going to be shared. They know what the tools are doing and how they're going to be helped by this. And so just providing that environment can help move things along much better. Thank you very much. Peter.
Hi, Thomas. So I'm working on a project right now, not an internal organizational one. This is for one of the products we have is archives.com, and we want to encourage sharing of family history.
Yep.
We did a bunch of research, and one of the things we found out is that particularly folks who are new to family history, before they share, they're willing to share it, they feel it needs to get to a certain stage of completeness, or because they don't want to look like an idiot, yep. kind of. That's not really what they say, but, yep. but they feel that a responsibility. However, we've also realized that the act of sharing, or rather collaboration, would actually help make this family history, like compile the family history. So people have this kind of fear of doing the thing that would actually help them in yep. their process. These are people that actually don't have many of these problems, right? They're their family, they know yep. them, their reputation, all that kind of stuff, but there's still this unwillingness to put something out there that isn't quote unquote ready.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering what you've seen in terms of getting people over that hump, getting them comfortable with sharing, even among a community, their family, that yeah. they should have a fairly high degree of other comfort with,
yeah.
that they don't want to somehow disturb, annoy, present something too early, or whatever it yeah. is that kind of prevents them from putting something that's unfinished out there
yeah.
In the interest of getting everyone to contribute.
It's very close to sort of the fear of public speaking. There's not a whole lot of people who are foolish enough to get up in front of people to talk. And it's sort of that fear of, you know, I don't want to say something foolish, or, you know, we want to be able, if you're finding somebody in the archives or a family and they're like, you know, this is Uncle Joe. You know, I found him, you know, why isn't he in anybody else's family tree? And like, it's not an uncle.
Who knows?
Yeah. And so, you know, you don't really want to make those mistakes, but being able to have, you know, a community and your family members be able to say, that's not an uncle, taking that sort of fear and that sort of unease out of it is really helpful. But a lot of that can be around framing just sort of how helpful it is to have other people involved. And framing it not so much as this is a finished project, but we're allowing people to work together and it's like, hey, you know, can anybody confirm this for me? And putting it in a frame of, this is a work in progress and I'm looking for help with this. And I have an awful lot of friends who are doing just insane deep dives on their family history and other things. And the folks that are comfortable with it, just they're bringing in all sorts of different family members. And they're comfortable doing that, and they're also sort of the personality type that are comfortable getting up in front of people and no problem making a fool of themselves and like, okay, learn something, next one. But having an interface that starts embracing and framing it as, this is a work in progress, can you help me? And put it sort of in empathetic terms where they're sharing it not as a finished product, but a work in progress and bringing the family together around it. And that could be actually be something and sort of looking at it from like a campfire. This is a comfortable space and it's for feedback and interaction around it before we bring other people in, and so that you're getting more completeness and more, all I've got is the 50 cent or the $1.50 word.
I can afford that.
You have more unity around it. And so that's, you know, bringing that in and just sort of using comfortable terms and terms that are very inclusive could help greatly.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Mine was more of a comment actually on Peter's question and your response, which I think is that with family, you have all of these same sort of social comfort issues, but they're more intensified at the extremes.
Yep.
If that makes sense, right? You are a lot more comfortable sharing those things with your family. And then there's some family where you're a lot less comfortable sharing them, and it's a lot, it's intensified because of the family relationship. So
yeah.
I don't know if that helps, Peter.
So I work with Salesforce on a product called Chatter, which is all about getting people to collaborate in businesses and so on and so forth. And one of the problems that I'm really interested in currently is that sometimes a group will sort of form around an interest and yep. work together, actually get to collaborate and get up to speed for a period of time, and then they want to invite someone else in,
yep.
but all they have is a mess of sort of yep. work that's been done. How do you sort of get a new person on board with something that's been moving, you know, and get them to sort of share and understand that existing group dynamic? I guess sort of the first thing you were talking about
yeah.
with the
first thing is Salesforce Chat or things like Yammer, other things like that, it's light years better than email because you don't have that repository to bring people into. I've got 40 to 50 social lenses to look at different things and frame things differently, and one of them is 20 social roles. And, you know, part of the social role is a sort of having somebody that's a curator, but a lot of the tools right now, the social tools, are missing the tools to be able to perform those social roles. We're still living in a world as if we're still living in small villages and we're living in cities, and we're missing the roles and the tools to be able to enable people to do that. So the gardener, the curator, the people that are making sense of things, the tools are missing, as well as sort of the embracing of that. But being, you know, sometimes the people who are coming in, you know, they're trying to make sense of things. If you can capture how they're making sense of things and dotted line that, and randomly bring people into the group, even if they may not have value, just to get that clarity in their framing can be helpful. But I'm happy to talk more. There's really background.
I was really fascinated by your whole exploration of the starring and the ambiguity between different systems. Like you said, in Gmail, maybe it's like you're collecting, or Twitter, maybe you're saying you're favoriting, you're maybe giving some form of props to someone. And I've been working on a project called Web Actions, where we're trying to understand what happens when people put those stars, not just, you know, when those stars leave that specific context of that site and goes to someone's individual sites, and it like acts across onto another site, right? Yep. So on your own personal blog, if you have a star, what does that mean? Does that star mean the same as like a Gmail private collection, or what is it star over on Twitter? And with like the explosion of like buttons everywhere, now, you know, we're all confused. How do we deal with that kind of complexity?
Yeah,
it's beyond just one site.
Yeah, it's the Catholic priest in his white robes going down to the south and running into a Klan convention. Kind of looks wrong. Same sort of similar look, same sort of like social statement, completely different understandings. And so it's, yeah, it's being able to capture the web intent or the intent of the actions and to have them be able to follow you and say, this is what this means. One of the things around sort of the social reticence of the click, have run into organizations where they have explicitly stated what the star means or the like button means, and people still have their own subculture meanings that they're sharing. And it's just like, this means that you like it. And other people are like, no, I don't like this, and I don't agree with it, but it's something that I want to hold on to because I'm working on a post or a white paper, and I'm using this as my straw man to frame the counter to this. But it looks, you know, and it's an awful lot of problems why people don't do things, because what they feel about things, they're not sure what other people are seeing in them. But it's sort of one of those tricky problems of how do we capture the intent. You know, perhaps it's a hover, and it's like, this is where this activity or this statement was made. And it's like, this was made in Gmail, and this is what it means. And so if you're surfacing something from Gmail into another service, it's like, oh, this was a bookmark or this was held onto within this system. And so it's being able to, you know, it's language translation of interface and social context.
I like the hypothesis of the hover to clarify it, but I'm wondering, is there actually a disincentive for sites to do that? For like something like Twitter, they don't care why you use the star, they actually just want you to use it, right? So to the site, there's a disincentive to provide clarity, but for the user or maybe the social dynamics that you're talking about, the comfort, there is an incentive. So how do we resolve that conflict? Like, what incentive does the site have to disambiguate it?
Yeah, I don't think the sites have any interest, and there's sort of a disruption that can happen and have a layer on top of it, and like a layer for social meaning. And I see an awful lot of problems within Twitter when Twitter changed their interaction design so that people were started getting emails and there was the activity stream that you could follow. And it's like, wow, you know, this person favorited this or liked this. And people were like, wow, thank you, you know, for favoriting my thing. I'm like, what? No, I'm just, you know, I'm laying in bed and like getting ready to get out of bed and I'm reading Twitter first and I gotta jump in the shower and I wanna come back and read this later and sort out what the hell you meant. And I'm like, it doesn't mean that I like it, it just means that I'm not there yet. I wanna come back to this. But it's like, there's all this like social awkwardness where we've taken the firm ground and turned it into sand and shifting and liquefying the ground. And that's problematic, but we're, you know, it's still really early in this. You know, how do we find our feet in the firm ground even when the ground is liquefying? But it seems to be that there's going to be a social layer of intent that helps disambiguate this because the services don't have it in their interest to do it. They're trying to get you to click, they're trying to get you to do things, they have their value, and it's not in their business sense to be able to take that step. And so there needs to be another, there's a meta social that needs to happen, in my perspective, and that would help. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this podcast from the 2012 IA Summit. The IA Summit podcasts are sponsored by the UIE Virtual Seminar Program with scores of online seminars your team can access on demand. For free access to a virtual seminar, visit uie.com/IAS12. And you can find the rest of the IA Summit podcasts at library.iasummit.org.